This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with the editor of the Baton Rouge Business Report, Stephanie Regal, with an update on what's going on a week before the opening of the legislative session. Tough times for Governor Jindal, as many allies are now opposing his tax plan, and his health secretary resigned under fire on Good Friday. We'll talk with Stephanie Regal about this and much more happening in Baton Rouge. And Scott Taylor Smith, his book is When Someone Dies, The Practical Guide to the Logistics of Death. Many people are unaware of some of the things that have to be done when someone dies, and Scott Taylor Smith covers them with earnest. We will talk with him as well. All this, but now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Stephanie Regal is our leadoff guest, the editor of the Baton Rouge Business Report. You may reach us at 297-5633 or 877-217-5757 or by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Good morning, Stephanie.
Good morning.
Well, last week, the Easter week, by all accounts, should have been a very good one for the governor with the big IBM announcement, and it was significant and certainly substantial for our community, but there's a lot of noise in the background. But let's start with IBM.
You the good news first, right?
You were covering that before it was announced, and took a lot of heavy lifting by many people in the community and around the state, and it happened, and it should be a good thing for us as a people here in Baton Rouge.
I think it really will be. And what we take a look at in our issue that comes out this week is particularly what it means for downtown, because I think the whole downtown revitalization aspect of it is so significant. And Stephen Morey talked about that the other day, and of course the Baton Rouge Area Foundation deserves so much credit for making that aspect of it happen, you know, through their for-profit real estate company, Commercial Properties. But Stephen said, you know, when the IBM guys were down here, they were looking for 100,000 square feet of office space. That was one of their needs, and they couldn't find anything. And so he said they started brainstorming and got together with BRAF and Commercial Properties and said, what can we do? And it was sort of like a, you know, kill two birds with one stone. Well, let's build them a new building. And then it not only makes it more attractive for them, but it makes a critical link, you know, of downtown revitalization along the riverfront. And there's so much going on down there now. Anyway, with Jim Bernhard owning the vacant piece of land next to it.
What's he going to do with that?
Oh, I don't know, but I'm sure he's going to do something. He's going to do something. So there's just a lot of action going on down there right now, and it's very, very exciting.
Mm-hmm. Well, Stephen Morey would probably like to go outside his office and shout for two reasons. One, that this happened, but secondly, because it's been overshadowed by other news. Starting with Friday, the health secretary, Bruce Greenstein, he resigns under fire, no doubt. Man's under federal investigation. What's going on with the governor and the department that he once headed as a member of Governor Foster's cabinet?
Well, I wish I had the inside scoop on that, and I don't. But, I mean, I think what you see is I think you see some serious weak spots in the administration, you know. And like everything, I mean, all the chickens come home to roost at once. And I think it's like the shark circling the water. You know, once you smell blood in one place, they start to come in. And I think there are going to be ripple effects and repercussions, you know, from this that are going to affect the tax plan and the legislature.
Well, there could be indictments on this front. And if there are, the one thing that I have said and others have is that the Jindal administration has been largely free of scandal. That's something he doesn't need at this time.
No, it's certainly not. It's certainly not. So, you know, I mean, I think it's very unfortunate. And I mean, I think, you know, history may judge this administration, I think, you know, favorably in the long run in terms of their reputation and their, you know, track record with respect to corruption relative at least to other administrations in Louisiana. But this is certainly going to be one of the black eyes. And they should have seen this coming. And I think, you know, it's the arrogance that a lot of people have criticized this administration for. And I think this may be an example of that.
And on Holy Thursday night, when the news media are getting ready for Easter, like everybody else, it was announced that the tax swap now has a higher threshold for the sales tax, 6.25%, up from 5.88%. That's a significant increase. What happened there?
It's a significant increase, and I think the thing that's so curious is the way that they didn't announce it. It just sort of snuck out, and just that day or the day before, Jindal had been in New Orleans meeting with business leaders about it and didn't even mention that. They appear to be all over the map. I mean, I think one of the main things they're going for with all of this is sort of the centralization of the tax collection at the state level, you know, and to weed out the parishes as much as possible. And at the end of the day, if they can achieve that with the tax package, maybe they'll be happy. You know, I can't believe that that they were this disorganized going in, and that all of these, you know, changes are coming out at the 11th hour. That doesn't look good.
Well, and people who ordinarily would support the governor, LABI, for example, not in the governor's camp. And when I say that, that's an understatement, profoundly against this plan. How can the governor get two-thirds support in the House and Senate with his former allies now expressing skepticism? And remind you, to get two-thirds support, he will need every Republican vote and about 10 Democratic votes in the House. It would seem to be something that at this point is going to be almost impossible to achieve.
No, I would agree. I don't see it happening without you know, with the active opposition of a group like LABI, which is what makes me think that what they're really going for at this point is just the centralization of the tax collection. You know, I mean, at this point, it looks like it's almost dead on arrival.
Well, the governor, does he have a fallback plan? We may find out.
You know, and I have to think with somebody like John Ilario, Senate president, who's just one of the most masterful, you know, legislators in our history, and who, you know, shepherded so much of Edwin Edwards' plans through the legislature for so many years, and now he's in the Jindal camp. You know, I mean, I think that's been one of Jindal's greatest assets in terms of, you know, getting his reform packages or his plans passed. It'd be interesting to have a conversation with John Ilario and see what he sees in the near future.
Stephanie Regal is with us, 297-5633, if you'd like to join us. C.B. Pragonston, who was on this show about a week ago and predicted passage of the Jindal tax swap, says now he is sending out a death notice. He says final arrangements have been made. After lying in state in the House of Representatives for 2 weeks, brief memorial services will be held at noon on Monday, April 15th in the Capitol Rotunda. Anyone wishing to speak at the services may sign a green card in any House committee room. LABI President Dan Juno will be officiating, and a wake is to be held at the home of LSU Professor Bob Mann on Sunday evening, April 14th.
I did see that. CB sent that out over the weekend.
A little humor from Mr. Fragonston, but it appears the governor will have to either do some severe arm twisting or move to another plan. Maybe he'll declare victory on a few items. I suspect he could get the cigarette tax passed if he wanted to, if he got behind that. So maybe that's the plan, to get a few things passed that will increase revenues and call it a victory and walk away.
Well, I think there will be some serious regrouping and retrenching in the days ahead. No doubt.
Well, and tomorrow, Bernie Pinsonet will reveal a poll which will show whether the last poll was a trend or not. And the last poll showed the governor slipping in his popularity. If Bernie's poll tomorrow shows the governor slipping even more, what happens at that point? Do lawmakers look at those sorts of things?
I think they do. And I've heard that the numbers are going to be pretty staggering compared to a year ago.
Really?
Yes.
You've heard that.
I have heard that.
Really?
So but I haven't seen them. But I feel comfortable in saying they are going to show certainly some slippage.
Well, Stephanie may know something we don't.
It's like everything else. It's with the Greenstein scandal. I think we can call it a scandal now.
Yes.
And resignation with the opposition to the tax plan, with the unfortunate poor showing he had up at the conservative convention up in Washington, D.C. in the straw poll. you see, and lawmakers smell blood. So I think they'll see it as weakness, and they will find strength in numbers and oppose it.
Dina asks if this is something that will have anything to do with the Medicaid expansion. The governor has steadfastly opposed this. Is this something that is something he can regroup on, or is it a case where he's too far down the road and can't lose face by changing his mind? What do you think?
And that may be a real watershed moment for him, or a real turning point moment, to see whether he is that far down the road and that determined to stay the course, or if he maybe thinks about what's in the best interest of the state and what he really has to do to go in a different direction.
Mm-hmm. Well, the governor was reelected with 66% of the votes in 2011. That's October of 2011. So we're talking about 17 months ago. And now here we are a year and a half later, and the governor's poll numbers will be perhaps at a level. Heaven forbid for the governor if they're lower than President Obama, who got it 41% last year in the state of Louisiana, last year being 5 months ago. But people will look at that poll that Pensinet reveals, and my guess, some people will denounce it rather quickly, but Bernie's a fairly good pollster.
Well, and the interesting thing is Bernie is a conservative pollster also.
That's his reputation.
And that
yes.
has been his reputation. I mean, he's an objective pollster and a very well respected pollster, but it's not mm-hmm. like people could say that he had an agenda against Jindal going into it. I do think, though, I mean, as you point out, 17 mm-hmm. months ago, and things change fast in politics. So I mean, this could be sort of a midterm, even though it's his second term, but a midterm mm-hmm. bump. And I think you really could see things turn around
right.
for Jindal. I mean, he's very, very smart and he's very, very strategic. I mean, I think he will do what he has to do to turn things around for his legacy. Well, and I mean, he's just too smart, I think, to let these problems mm-hmm. build and tank his career at this point in it.
At 41.
That's right.
He's got
no doubt he will get beyond this. Now, how exactly, I don't know.
Well, he'll leave office when he's, 44 or 43, 44, he'll be out. That's the age that Romer and Edwards were elected governor. But then the plan, I'm sure, is for him to run for president the next year. If that doesn't work out, Then what? He's got a lot of time and a lot of experience. Probably would be a much wiser public servant the second time around, but there may not be another time if this does not go well. And I don't know what Bernie's poll is going to show, but Stephanie called him a conservative pollster. And to show you how conservative Bernie is, a few years ago when David Vitter was embroiled in his scandal, I asked him at that time, I said, if Mary Landrieu was caught with male prostitutes, could she survive? And he said yes. And we know that's not true. There's a double standard. But yet David Vitter was elected going away, a landslide win over Charles Melanson. If a scandal broke today that Mary Landrieu had been seeing male prostitutes, there's no way she would win re-election next year.
No, I don't think so.
But Bernie said yes.
I don't think she would.
And Bernie was wrong. But his polls have nothing to do with his opinions. These are just numbers that are done and people polled from all over the state. And we will talk with Bernie Wednesday about whether or not the governor's poll numbers are any better than they were the last go-around. But he got a lot of grief from the administration, I know, when his survey showed the governor not doing as well as anticipated.
Interesting.
Yeah, so.
It'll be worth watching for mm-hmm. sure.
Well, F. King Alexander, before we go to the break, the new president of LSU, is that something that is a good thing, or do we not know?
Well, I think I think from what we do know about him and do know about his track record, he seems like what the university needs. I think he's the right man for the job at this point, given the reorganization and the new role that he will be assuming. I mean, when you meet him, he definitely has a very, very strong and appealing personality. So I think he's going to be a good leader, in terms of his background, and some have said weak on academics. I don't know that really matters so much. in the job that he's been brought here to do.
Okay. We'll be back with Stephanie Regal and take inquiries from you. 297-5633 is the number. Back after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to WRKF 89.3 in Baton Rouge. Stephanie Regal, editor of the Baton Rouge Business Report, is with us. And Stephanie has had a few jobs in journalism over the last couple of decades. She was at WWL in New Orleans for how many years?
13 almost.
13, and then came back to LSU, to Baton Rouge. She, of course, is a graduate of the Manship School of Mass Communication and did so for good right after Katrina in 2005. So we're coming up on 8 years, right?
It's hard to believe, really.
And you've been at the Business Report, the Advocate. You've done some work for WAFB, and now you're with us. And here's a question from Miriam. She says, I miss your healthy take on food and cooking in The Advocate. Do you have any tips on healthier eating for busy professionals, particularly those with children?
Oh, and you know what I would tell Miriam, and I so appreciate that, because it really was a passion of mine. And, you know, it was interesting. There was a lot of resistance among some of the older readers at The Advocate who just did not like that at all, which was not the reason I left. But my sister Tracy Cook and I do write a food column in 225. Called Dining In, and it's in 225 magazine every month, and you can also get it online at 225br.com. And we have wonderful, fast, healthy, nutritionally balanced recipes, so I would encourage her to please read that column.
Stephanie is one who definitely practices what she preaches. Here's a question from Lisa. She says, there's no bio of you on the Business Report website. None for Ralph, none for JR. What's going on?
Oh, my. Well, we will see to that.
Yeah, we need
we
to know about
to
these,
that.
These people.
Thank you for pointing that out.
Okay.
I was unaware.
All right. 297-5633 for Stephanie Regal. She worked 13 years at WWL. And tomorrow in the Business Report, there will be a cover story on downtown revitalization. When you were in school a few years ago at LSU, downtown was a veritable wasteland, and now it's something to behold and is going to get even better.
Really, when you look at the transformation, it's just phenomenal. And, you know, you see the value of planning. You know, I think so much of this started with the plan Baton Rouge of the 1998. There was a Riverfront Master Plan in 2003. There was a follow-up plan, Baton Rouge II, in 2009. And you have, and I hate this word because it's so overused, stakeholders. But you really do see all the stakeholders and a shared vision. And that's another cliche that I hate. But it really is true in this instance of what you've seen downtown with the Baton Rouge Area Foundation, with the commitment from the city parish government, with the Downtown Development District, you know, a taxing district to make it all happen, a plan they've actually followed and not just let sit on a shelf. You know, zoning and land use that go hand in hand together. It's exciting, and you think if you could do this all over the parish, how great it would be. And then you have things like historic building tax credits, which have enabled a lot of the older buildings along 3rd Street to be redeveloped affordably. And now you see sort of the synergy that is created with deals hopefully like IBM, you know, some of these new buildings that are down there, and that attracts more people, and then restaurants open up. You've seen the first little service-related businesses like a pharmacy that opened on 3rd Street. There's a quick care clinic that opened on 3rd Street. There's going to be a corner grocery store opening up later.
Yeah, and the old State National Life building.
It's a start. I mean, the trick is to get a major grocery store down there, and you need more residents down there. But it's been a chicken and an egg sort of situation. How do you get the people without the services? How do you get the services without the people? I think that's one reason why everybody is so enthused about this IBM deal. Even though it's just 100 units in the apartment building, that's still a lot. That's 100 more that you put in the mix, and then that brings, you know, the number up even further. They need to get to close to 10,000, you know, within a certain radius of downtown. And they're getting there. And once they get to that magic number, then you're really going to see the significant development come.
Mm-hmm. And it would be nice to see some of the downtown development people move downtown as well to set an example. 297-5633 is your number. Pam at LSU. Pam, good morning. You're on the air with Stephanie Regal.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Stephanie.
Good morning.
I confess that usually stack up my food sections of the Advocate and read them all at one time. And so when your departure came last spring, I missed it for a few weeks. So I never got a chance to thank you for the social conscience you brought to the food section. I know that's an odd thing to say, but I really appreciate it. I realize you took a risk in doing it, and I just want you to know that I read it, and I appreciate it very much, and I continue to follow your work.
Well, thank you so much. I can't tell you how much I appreciate that. I really, really do. Because, again, it was a very personal thing, you know, and you do take a risk out there. And you know, unfortunately, I heard more from the detractors than from the supporters back then. But I'm glad to know that there were supporters out there. And as I said, we do continue to write about it. We're just in 225 now instead of the food section.
Mm-hmm. And Stephanie is living proof that you can enjoy the great cuisine in this area and stay fit, very fit. You work at it.
Well, thank you. Yeah. We did the Crescent City Classic in New Orleans over the weekend. Mm-hmm. That was a wonderful event.
Really?
Wonderful event.
10K,
and
right?
And Corporate Cup, that was a 10K.
What was your time?
Oh, and it wasn't that 47.
47?
47.
Now that's
47 and some change.
That's moving. That's impressive.
And we did the...
You're not pulling a Paul Ryan here, are you?
No. The Corporate Cup was the weekend before in downtown Baton Rouge, and that was another example of just how alive Baton Rouge is, to see so many people from so many companies in the new town square. It was a delightful run through the streets of downtown, and it was so much fun to see so much action, you know, and to finish up right there in the big new town square. So,
well, now that John Georges is about to take over the Advocate, maybe we'll return the Great River Road Run that the Advocate used to sponsor. That was a big event in this community every spring. We haven't had it since 2000. That's 13 years without a Great River Road Run.
Wow. And that predates me living here. But I think you'll see a lot of changes when John Georges
And you've been all over that story, and I think it's fairly obvious that you have some access to Mr. Georges, who's he's a very sociable fellow, by the way. He's a Facebook friend of mine, and he already is getting around town quite a bit. His restaurant is doing exceptionally well as far as foot traffic.
We were there yesterday,
last night. But what about him becoming a publisher?
I think John Georges will do what he does, you know, and what he has done with his other companies and been very successful at. I think he's going to put the people in place to run that newspaper. You know, I mean, he may be the publisher in name only, but I think he's going to put some really strong, experienced people in the key leadership positions on the editorial side.
Well, they've got some strong, experienced people working there now. So what does that mean?
Absolutely they do. But, I mean, I think he will probably bring in some fresh faces.
Well, generally that's what happens when people buy things.
Generally it is.
And run companies, as he's run a lot of them. But what does he know about the newspaper business?
He doesn't know a lot. But I don't know that he knew about other...
He didn't know about Galatoires either, right?
So he hires the people who do. And I think that's his plan.
Well, being publisher of what is now the biggest paper in the state, now that the Picayune has gone to 3 days a week, and we can talk as much as we want about NOLA.com, which is doing great work and a fine staff, and they're doing great work here in this community. But when we're talking about the printed newspaper, for whatever it's worth, the Advocate at 7 days a week, with now about, 25,000 subscribers in the New Orleans area, is the paper of record in our state. So he has an opportunity, if he wishes, to use that as a vehicle for his political objectives. He's run for office a few times. Do you think he'll do that?
He has said that he will, run for office?
No, that he will use it to advance. Maybe he'll write a column, for example, like another publisher we know.
I would hope he's smarter than that. Because I think it would be so transparent. I don't think that was his motive in going after this paper. I really don't. I do think it gives him access to key power circles in other parts of the state, you know, to own a business such as a newspaper. I don't know. We'll have to see. But I think he senses correctly that there is a lot of business opportunity in daily papers still. You see Warren Buffett buying up newspapers in cities about the size of Baton Rouge, a little bit smaller, a little bit bigger. He's figured out how to make money doing it. You know, long term, 20 or 50 years out, I don't think there's money in newspapers, but I think for a 5 or a 10 year business plan, I think there's still money to be made, and I think John has an idea of how he can do it. It may even expand beyond Baton Rouge. I don't know. I don't think his primary motive is to advance his political agenda, which I think exists. I think there is a political agenda, but I don't think that's why he's buying the Advocate.
He's going to run for office again at some point, I would think, and he's got the resources to do it. 297-5633 is your number for Stephanie Regal, who I think was first on the story about the Advocate being up for sale. Now, what kind of debt load will Mr. Georges have? He's not going to buy this for probably, what, I think at least $50 million, counting the debt.
I mean, those are the numbers that we've, you know, talked about. I mean, I don't mean I have talked about with him, but those are the numbers that have been talked about. When we did a story on it last year, we reported that the paper was maybe still carrying about $30 million in debt because of the printing presses that they had bought out on Segan Lane several years ago. At that point, David Manship said that they had paid off 2/3 of the debt, you know, so that would roughly be $30 million. How they structure the deal, you know, I don't know.
Well, The Advocate is a paper that has been bravely attacking the governor on occasion and defending him at some points, but I think it's known, rightly or wrongly, as an anti-Jindal vehicle right now. In fact, the governor even blamed his poor showing in Baton Rouge in 2011 on The Advocate. Was that fair?
I don't think it's fair at all. I mean, I think The Advocate's Capitol Bureau is probably its finest asset. You know, I mean, I think they've always led in state news, and I think they are just consistently conscientious and thorough and diligent in their reporting. You know, I don't.
All right. 297-5633 for Stephanie Regal, who is editor of the Baton Rouge Business Report, formerly with The Advocate, and she was the food editor there. John on Burbank. John, good morning. You're on with Stephanie.
Jim, Stephanie, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't acknowledge the part that Governor Foster played in funding Mark Drennan's plan for the state office buildings back downtown, long before private industry did anything about that. The governor and Drennan did that.
Talking about Drennan and the state office.
No, absolutely, and I did want to mention that because, you know, that went hand in hand with the plan Baton Rouge that started in 1998. But it was also around that time, and even it was around that time that Mark Drennan, as commissioner of administration, helped bring all of the state office workers and buildings back to downtown Baton Rouge, and that was a tremendous part of it. And that's really what I was alluding to when I was talking about all the stakeholders, you know, coming together with a shared vision for a revitalized downtown. And that was, you're correct, a very, very important element in the whole scheme.
Before Drennan, the Department of Environmental Quality was renting office space from Jimmy Swaggart Ministries. Now the Advocate is doing that. So, but the move now appears to be to sell some of the state office buildings. That's part of the governor's plan to balance the budget. There have been a few eyebrows lifted on that one.
You know, it's a curious budget balancing technique that, yes, some people have definitely called into question. I mean, the state always sells off surplus supplies, so it's not very unusual to necessarily sell off extra assets, extra properties that it no longer needs. They don't typically use them to balance a budget. They don't typically fold those anticipated revenues into the revenue side of the general operating budget. I think that's the most curious thing about it. But just to get rid of buildings that maybe could be put to higher and better use, you know.
Right. Here's a question from Devin in North Baton Rouge, I'll read the question. He's got some information here that may or may not be accurate, but he says Governor Jindal is the first governor since Jimmy Davis not to have an African-American cabinet secretary. Why hasn't the local media, state media, covered this?
That's an interesting point, and I'm not...
I don't know of any.
I don't know.
Cynthia Bridges was in his cabinet but got fired. I don't know of any African-Americans now, and I do recall the other governors having at least one, in some cases more than one, African-American interesting.
That is an interesting point.
I do know that when Governor ran for governor in 2003, or 2007, rather, he was questioned about not having any African-Americans on his staff in Washington, which I think is a valid issue. 297-5633, Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, good morning. You're on the air with Stephanie Regal.
Good morning, Jim. Yeah, my question is this. It's been becoming proven that the austerity doesn't work. I know over in Greece, there's the hue and cry that, gee, we're going to become just like Greece. Well, the fact is what they're doing over in Greece is selling state property, lowering taxes on business, and lowering wages. So that austerity is the same thing that Jindal's trying to do in our state. Economists like Paul Krugman and other leading thinkers are saying that austerity is exactly the wrong way to go.
As far as stimulating the economy, there are those who believe the governor is not on the right track. But the governor, when he runs for president, and it, I don't think it's a question of if, but when, he will probably run saying, look, I cut the size of government. I was able to balance the budget. The unemployment rate in Louisiana was lower than in other states, and we had many big hits as far as attracting economic giants like IBM. So there's a story to be told. Of course, there's a backstory that will also be told, but can he sell it? Can he sell it to the American people?
That will be the question. You know, what's interesting is I think what you're going to see happening in Louisiana, though, over the next few years, because of the low price of natural gas and all of these shale plays, you know, with the fracking, is that we're going to have the most tremendous industrial construction boom in history. I mean, it's like we have a second bite of the apple again.
Yeah.
And I think the ripple effects in the long term are going to be just tremendous for this state. So at the end of the day, you know, regardless of his programs, he may end up presiding over one of the most, you know, successful economic expansions in Louisiana history. And it may really have nothing to do with him.
2.5 years to go, and we'll see how it goes. What about the money that will come from BP? Where will this money go? Will it be used to pay bills, or will it be used for coastal restoration?
Well, let's hope that it's used for a little bit of everything, you know.
Well, some say it should all be used for coastal issues.
It should, it should be, you know. I mean, and we have to get serious about
that. You know that better
than
anybody. Was your house destroyed in Katrina?
My house was under 8 feet of water. It was not totally destroyed, actually. We have rebuilt it, you know, through the Road Home program.
8 feet of water will usually do some damage.
But 8 feet of water, thankfully, it was a two-story house. 8 feet of water is pretty serious damage.
Were you in the house when the water started coming up?
No, I was up here reporting for Channel 4 from LSU because we thought that the entire French Quarter was going to be underwater at that point. So we had moved half of the news staff up to Baton Rouge, and the other half had moved to the West Bank of Jefferson Parish in New Orleans.
297-5633. We'll be back to spend a few more minutes with Stephanie Regal if you'd like to get under the wire with the editor of the Baton Rouge Business Report. J.R. Ball's the executive editor, and Stephanie is the editor. Who's higher on the...
J.R. J.R. is in charge of everything, including 225 in register.
He is large and in charge, and Stephanie is lean and mean, and we shall return in a minute and a half with Stephanie Regal. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. J.C. Kane is producing today as Kevin Gallagher takes a day off. And Stephanie Regal is with us for a few more moments, the editor of the Baton Rouge Business Report. It's been around for over 30 years now and is considered to be the Bible of business news in our community. And a listener wanted to know, based on your background in television in New Orleans, how well did you know Angela Hill and Alec Gifford? And before we get Stephanie's take on this, these are two people who are local legends in New Orleans and kind of like Donna Britt is here and George Sells and some other people who have been around a long time in this community on television that people get to feel like they know them. And two people who survived for, over three decades, Alec, 5 decades, and Angela Hill.
I think it was 38 years
for
she
her,
was on WWL TV.
And 51 years for Alec Gifford. Did you know them?
I knew them both. I knew Angela very well, professionally at least, very well, because she was the lead anchor at the station for the entire time that I was there. And just a lovely lady, and like you say, I mean, the Donna Britt of New Orleans, except even more so, mm-hmm. because she was on the air that much longer, just beloved by the community. And she announced her retirement just last Wednesday and took, I think, a lot of people by surprise. But she's going to continue to produce pieces for the station, long-form pieces. It gets to be a lot, you know, after that many years. Mm-hmm. And I think she's wise to go out while she's on top and still have time to enjoy her days, because TV is a grind.
Yeah, I guess it is. Of course, once people are on, they generally don't want to get off.
Well, there's nothing like it. You know, I mean, I think really once you've had a good run on TV, there's never anything that quite fits as well. And Alec Gifford, he was a legend also, and just a lovely person. I didn't know him as well because he was at a competing station, but he was back on the air when I was a reporter. So even then, he was probably in his early 80s.
I bet you grew up watching him, right?
Oh, I watched him growing up. I mean, I watched them both growing up. You know, Angela came to New Orleans when I was about 8 or 9. Mm-hmm. And Alec had
Yeah, and she ended up marrying her co-anchor. There was a big soap opera, Garland Robinette, right?
Oh, but they were wonderful together.
They both left their spouses to be with each other?
No, I don't think she was married at the time.
Okay.
She was not. And I don't know about him, that maybe, but they were wonderful together, and you could see the chemistry when they were on the air.
But sometimes chemistry on the air doesn't translate to real life.
Well, and I guess in their case, it didn't, because they didn't stay together married, but they are still friends to this day, and I know they have lunch and they talk, and you can hear him on WWL radio, which sometimes comes out to this area.
Yes, and of course Garland is a guy who was under investigation himself recently. For a $25,000 payment he got from Fred Hebe that he did not report, but he has survived that. And we are forgiving people in Louisiana, aren't we?
Well, you have a memory like a sieve. You remember everything that happened to everybody.
But television often has people who are characters. I guess that's why they're successful in that industry. And I got an inquiry here from Caitlin saying, I always talk about the people from AFB, and never mention the people from BRZ. The BRZ has some talented people, and she says you never have any of them as guests. I would love to have Sylvia Weatherspoon as a guest, or Michael Marsh as a guest. If they will come on this show, that would be wonderful. But
have you ever invited them?
Yeah, well, I've invited Sylvia. I don't know if I've invited Michael, but Sylvia to this point has not obliged to be on the show, and I've invited Whitney Van and some others, but they haven't come on this show, and I don't bite. So
it may be a manship rule or something, but you know, I know them, and they are very fine journalists over there. We used to produce our little cooking show at WBRZ, and they are a wonderful crew, and John Pastorek.
Well, how will that work now that the television station is owned by the manships and the newspaper is owned by John George's? Will there be a division, or will they still be collaborative on many endeavors, like Pat Shingleton, for example? His words are in the paper every day.
I don't know how that's
Shingleton's
going to
been
work
on the show. Yeah, I've had Pat Shingleton on a few times. Yeah, so
I don't know.
Yeah, but
I don't know.
I mentioned when Ed Cullen retired a few weeks ago and he was on this show, rarely is there a story done about people in television by the newspaper, and I would think that would be good to have a feature, like Donna Britt, for example, or Sylvia Weatherspoon. There should be a feature on them.
You know, the Times-Picayune, and still does, in fact, have a really good television critic that reports on local news and local media. I used to follow local media when I wrote for the Business Report before I was editor there, and I do think it's a niche. I mean, I think people are interested in the TV personalities and in the TV stations. I mean, I think you see a lot more about WAFB just because their ratings are so dominant in this market. In fact, I did a little story that's in the Business Report that comes out today about some of the latest ratings.
They went up even more, didn't they?
They were. I mean, their February book, their morning show, was tremendous. It was like one of the biggest leads they've ever had, a 48-point share, which is just tremendous, tremendous. So, you know, I don't know what that says about this market necessarily, But a lot more people are watching AFB at this point than BRZ.
A lot of people.
Or VLA or Fox 44, you know.
Well, Fox has, Channel 33, they were out of the game for a long time, and
yes,
they're back in, and it's hard to make up ground, and so their ratings show that. Now, if we were in a three-station battle or four-station battle, which would be the norm for market number 84, 85. Actually, television's a little bit. Television's about 95, I think. But we generally should have about three stations that get significant ratings, but we don't. So that pushes the numbers for AFB and for BRZ ahead of the pack, and the numbers for BRZ are not bad. They're just way behind AFB.
Right. And we saw this in New Orleans, too, with WWL had a lead for so long. And the other stations have caught up in the post-Katrina years. But, you know, Louisianans are very tradition-bound, and we like our habits, and we like our personalities, and people tend to watch the same station over and over again. And it's just hard to break those viewing habits that are entrenched.
Well, thank you for joining us today, Stephanie Regal. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
And we're joined now by Scott Taylor Smith. He's a partner at Viant Capital, a San Francisco-based boutique investment bank and tech business incubator committed to strategic advisory and capital raising services to emerging growth to small and mid-market companies. And his first book is When Someone Dies. Good morning, Scott Taylor Smith.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, nice to talk with you early in the day in the Bay Area. But this is called A Practical Guide to the Logistics of Death. I think people are unaware of how much it costs to die. I was talking with some people in their 80s the other day, and they were unaware that when you die, you have to pay for the obituary in the newspaper.
That
was just a public service, but obituaries are big business, aren't they?
Well, it's a very big business, and most newspapers charge by the word, so brevity is a virtue. One of the things we recommend in the book is that you write a long-form obituary and really give all of the details of a person's life and send that out to the various organizations that will publish it for free. For example, the Alumni Association of the college and professional organizations. But the actual obituary, if you print one at all, and you're not required to print one, but if you do, it should be very short.
Yeah, because it's going to cost you some money. What's the general going rate, though, for an obituary when you pay by the word?
Well, it's all over the place. It goes from as little as a dollar a word to as much as $75 a word. The New York Times is probably the most expensive.
$75 a word for an obituary?
Oh, it can be very expensive.
My goodness.
One of the other things we point out is that if you do publish an obituary, it's very important that you not print the time of the memorial service. A lot of times thieves will be following the obituaries and will be looking to see when the memorial service is, and then they'll go rob the house at that time.
That is a good point. That would be a double whammy, to lose a loved one and to be robbed while you're attending their funeral.
Exactly.
Does that really happen that often?
I don't think it happens that often. There's a very famous situation in Northern California where it happened recently. A family was driving home from their trip to Hawaii. They'd parked their van at the airport, and they were all driving home quite happy from their vacation, and they were struck by a drunk driver. And because of just the massive tragedy of it, it received a lot of press. And in that case, it actually did happen. Some thieves from Oakland came up to the house in Sonoma and burglarized it during the memorial service.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about having a will or not having one? Like, for example, I know intelligent people, probably the most brilliant American of the 20th century, Martin Luther King. He did not have a will. Why is it important to have a will?
Oh, it's very important. The purpose of a will is to identify who gets what out of an estate. And it's particularly in today's world where we have very transitory lives, where we know a lot of people, we may marry once or twice, and we may have children and stepchildren. It's just really important for everybody to write down who they want their possessions to go to. Another really important thing is, particularly with aging parents today, it's so important to sit down and talk to them and find out what their intentions are, what their goals are, what type of memorial they would want, and also to find out where the documents are and to put them in a safe, very accessible place. You know, for example, where are the deeds to any real property someone might have? Where is the car? Where's the registration for the car? You know, if there is a will, finding the will and making sure we have it. As our parents age, it's really important for people to put a medical directive and a power of attorney on file. A medical directive basically is a document that says, look, if I become comatose or if I become incapacitated, this is the level of ongoing life support I want. You know, you can choose to have just palliative care, just morphine, or you can say you want, you know, invasive surgery to be kept alive. And then you designate a person who has the power of attorney to act in your place at that time.
Now, when a person dies, a lot of times family members are scrambling to buy a casket and to make arrangements. You suggest, Scott Taylor Smith, that those kinds of things should be done ahead of time.
Well, 50 years ago, most people, you know, had purchased a funeral plot for the family and had made some sort of arrangement for the funeral. Today, most people just don't do that, and so most people pass away without any arrangements. You know, I think most funeral homes are very ethical businesses, and I don't mean to say a bad word about them. On the other hand, they are a business. They're in the business to make money. And right after someone passes away, a series of very important decisions have to be made. How many death certificates do you want? What type of casket? What type of arrangements do you want? You know, if you're green or environmentally inclined, a lot of people are opting for cremation, because burying a body full of formaldehyde is a very toxic gesture to the earth. But, you know, knowing what the party's intended is just very important at that time.
Well, in the book, you have something that you say you should handle your loved one's online footprint. What do you mean?
Well, we all have Facebook pages. We might have a Twitter account. We have, you know, various personas online. And when you pass away, you want to make sure that that you're memorialized correctly. And Facebook, for example, which is probably one of the biggest websites, has a policy where you can go to Facebook, explain the circumstances that somebody passed away and what your relationship is to the deceased, and then you can get access to their page to, quote, memorialize them. You can basically do whatever you want in terms of marking their passage. But this is, you're bringing up a really important point that I really want to emphasize. People in America, we are terrified of death, and we think that death is almost a communicable disease. So when we have a friend whose husband or wife is dying, we tend to walk away and hide rather than help. And when someone passes away, I think it's very important that you broadcast as broadly as possible that fact. So what we did in my mother's case was, I have three sisters. We divided her address book into quarters, and we called everybody in the book, having no idea whether my mom was still in touch with them or not, because it's very important to let people know. People want to know. They want to help. And I just think it's very important.
Well, it's an important book, When Someone Dies, The Practical Guide to the Logistics of Death. And it's remarkable. We'll talk about a lot of things, but death seems to be the one topic that is a deal breaker with a lot of folks. They just don't want to deal with it.
They don't. One of the things that I've done in the book is I've tried to answer the perennial questions that always come up when someone passes away. I'll give you one example. Let's suppose your sister passes away, and like most of us, she lived paycheck to paycheck. She had not accumulated a lot of wealth. And yet when she passes away, she owes $35,000 to two credit card companies. And the question always comes up, do we, the living, the survivors, have to pay off her credit cards? And the answer is emphatically no. But the credit card companies aren't going to tell you that, and they're going to pester you. Now, there are two exceptions to that general rule. And the first one is, if you're married and the debt was incurred in the community of the marriage, then the surviving spouse probably most likely has to continue paying the credit card debts. And the other one is, suppose I change the facts just a little bit, and your sister, right before she died, she won the lottery, and she had $100,000 in her checking account. if you take the $100,000 as her heir, then legally you are obliged to pay the credit card companies.
Well, the book is When Someone Dies from Simon & Schuster with Scott Taylor Smith and Michael Castleman. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye. And today is April Fool's Day, April 1st, born on this date in 1944. Rusty Staub, the man from Jesuit High School in New Orleans. He started his Major League Baseball career in 1965 with the Houston, 1963 with the Houston Colt 45s. One of only three men in Major League history to hit home runs in the big leagues as a teenager and as a 40-year-old. And a correction both from Trevor in Hammond and Colonel Henry Johnson saying it was a $250,000 payment or loan, not $25,000. It went from Mr. Hebe to Mr. Robinette. Thank you, Trevor, and thank you, Henry. And thank you for listening, everybody. Until tomorrow, stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.